right now.
Is everything all right, Theron?
Jace's voice chimed in.
Where are you calling from?
Reaver Station.
Are you insane?
It's okay. The signal's secure, for now.
You can't know that. What if the...
I don't have much time, Theron said, cutting him off. I think the mission's been compromised.
Why?
Jace demanded.
The Empire should have used the Black Ciphers to transmit the orders to the capital ships. We should have known about the attack.
There was a moment of silence on the other end of the line, before Jace said,
We knew.
You knew?
Theron said, his mind struggling to grasp what he was hearing.
Why weren't we better prepared? Why didn't you do anything?
We sent medical supplies, food, and emergency volunteers,
Jace replied.
What about the reinforcements? Why were they too far away to get there in time? We should have scrambled one of our fleets.
We couldn't. The risk of tipping off the Empire was too great. If they found a fleet waiting for them on Ruan, they'd know we were intercepting their cipher transmissions.
Horror slowly dawned on Theron as he realized what Jace was saying.
You knew the Empire would wipe out our ships at Ruan? You knew they'd bombard the planet? Thousands of civilians are dead, and you did nothing to help them?
I had no choice. If we don't stop the Ascendant Spear, we don't stop this war. You're worried about thousands of innocent lives, but I'm worried about millions.
Theron didn't say anything. He sat in the pilot's chair, speechless, as Satil's warning ran through his mind.
Jace fights this war out of revenge. It clouds his judgment. It can make him do terrible things if he believes they are necessary to save the Republic.
Theron,
Jace said from the other end of the transmission.
Theron, are you still there?
We're here.
Nostral spoke up.
You have to see the big picture, Theron. We have to wait for our chance to stop the spear, no matter how horrific these attacks may be.
Attacks?
Theron said, snapping out of his daze.
Ruan wasn't the only one?
Theron,
the director's voice snapped.
Your job is to get on board the spear. This doesn't concern you.
Where will they strike next?
Theron demanded, ignoring the director.
Jace! Where?
Duro,
the Supreme Commander said with a heavy sigh.
They're going to hit the shipyards in 36 standard hours.
Duro was a heavily industrialized and densely populated world. Though the planet itself was too polluted to support life, billions lived in the orbital cities above it. An Imperial attack on Duro would have minimal long-term strategic value for the Empire, but the casualties for the Republic were almost too catastrophic to fathom.
You have to stop them,
Theron said.
Set an ambush! Take out the Imperial fleet the second they enter the system!
That's not going to happen. The Spear isn't going to be involved in the attack.
We're increasing Republic patrols in the sector,
the director added.
But if we scale them up too fast, the Empire will grow suspicious.
Theron, sometimes sacrifices have to be made.
But you have to draw the line somewhere!
The Empire won't, so neither can we.
Satil was right about you,
Theron thought, remembering her final argument.
Hate will transform you into the very evil that you are fighting so hard against.
There's nothing you can do to stop this, Theron,
the director told him.
So do your duty. Complete your mission. The Republic is counting on you.
The transmission abruptly ended, though Theron wasn't sure if they had cut him off or if the Reaver's automated security systems had finally unraveled his tricks and disconnected the signal.
Chapter 23.
Theron stood up from the pilot's seat slowly, his body and mind numb.
Theron?
Nostral asked.
Are you okay?
The director was right, Theron replied. There's nothing we can do. An Imperial fleet is going to hit Duro and we can't stop it.
Call back,
Tefeth suggested.
Tell them you quit.
There may be another way, If the spear was part of the Imperial fleet attacking Duro, Jace would be willing to set up an ambush.
But it's not, Theron said, his mind unable to follow where the Jedi was heading. The spear will still be here when Duro is attacked.
Maybe not. Can you send off another message?
Theron shook his head. Used every trick in my bag to pull that off. The network security programs automatically adjust and adapt to slicer attacks. They'll be able to lock me out almost instantly if I try it again. Probably even trace the location to this hangar.
Then we need someone to deliver it.
Nos D'Aral turned to Tefith.
We need your help.
Not trying anything to get us killed, she warned.
All you have to do is deliver a message. Tell Jace Malcolm that the Ascendant Spear will be at Duro.
She'll never be able to get a message to the Republic Supreme Commander, Theron said, suddenly understanding where Nos D'Aral was headed.
But I know who can. Satil.
I should have thought of her myself. Go to the Jedi Enclave on Coruscant,
he said to Tefith, speaking quickly.
Ask for Grandmaster Satil Shan. Tell her everything that happened here.
We fly Imperial Shuttle to Coruscant, we get blown from the sky,
Tefith protested.
Go back to Jaganiport and take my shuttle,
Nos D'Aral said.
It's faster anyway.
We leave, you two going to be stuck on River Station,
Tefith reminded them. From her tone, Theron wasn't sure if she was worried about them or sarcastically pointing out something obvious she thought they were foolishly forgetting.
Theron and I can look after ourselves.
Tell the authorities that I sent you, Theron said. Grandmaster Shan will listen if you mention my name.
Grandmaster Shan?
Tefith said, her eyes narrowing suspiciously as she put two and two together.
Theron Shan, you related?
She's my mother,
Theron said, the situation too urgent for him to even care whether Nos D'Aral already knew. He expected Tefith to make some kind of comment, maybe ask why he wasn't a Jedi. But all she said was,
What's he need for us?
Another 10,000 credits, Theron promised. And a get-out-of-jail-free card if you're ever arrested in Republic space.
Deal.
Nos D'Aral turned his attention back to Theron.
You still need to get on the spear. If you don't sabotage the systems, Carrot will be able to escape the Republic ambush.
I'm on it, Theron said. What about you?
I'm going to convince my old apprentice to take her ship to Duro.
Pulling the hood of his cloak up over his head to obscure his features, the Jedi slipped out of the shuttle and took off, moving with the supernatural speed of one driven by the Force. Theron watched him until he vanished through the hangar door, leaving him and Tefith alone.
Can I trust you on this?
He asked the Twi'lek.
Millions of innocent lives are at stake.
10,000 credits to deliver one message? Stupid not to do it.
Good. Tell Satil Shan everything that happened here. She has to convince Jace to send the Republic fleet to Duro.
Theron wondered what the Director or Jace would say once they learned that a Twi'lek enforcer for the old Tian Brotherhood now knew all the critical details of their top-secret mission. He'd probably get court-martialed, and rightfully so. But he trusted Tefith. More important, he didn't have any other options. Not if he wanted to keep Duro from being the site of one of the war's bloodiest massacres. He started to leave the ship, then paused to say one last thing to Tefith.
Remember, he warned her, double-cross us, and you don't get paid.
Got it,
she said, her leku flicking in annoyance.
Said stupid not to do it. We're not stupid.
Nos D'Aral was little more than a blur of motion and movement as he raced through the corridors of Reaver Station. The Imperial soldiers he flew past reacted with a mix of surprise, curiosity, and alarm, but he came and went so fast, none of them fully realized what had happened. Left in his wake, they exchanged a few puzzled glances with their friends, then laughed off the odd but seemingly harmless encounter, as their minds convinced them that the person who just run by couldn't possibly have been moving that fast. He didn't know exactly where he was going, but he let the Force guide him. When they'd first arrived at Reaver Station, He had gently reached out with his mind until he sensed his former Padawan. Now he was using her familiar presence, shrouded in the dark side, but still unmistakable after so many years, as a beacon to guide him to her. At the same time, he was careful to mask his own presence so as not to warn her of his coming. As he drew closer, it would be impossible to completely hide himself from her awareness should she suddenly choose to focus her thoughts on finding him. But there was no reason she would do so, not until he was so close that it no longer mattered. As he drew near the Ascendant Spear's hangar, he slowed his pace. There were more people here, men and women returning from or heading out on shore leave, but none of the off-duty soldiers paid him any special heed. Those coming back to the ship were tired and inebriated, and those leaving were too eager to begin their leave to pay close enough attention to the hooded figure's hidden features to realize he wasn't human. That changed when he reached two guards on duty at one of the many boarding ramps leading from the hangar floor into the spear itself.
"Who are you?"
one demanded, stepping in his path. She moved with a sure confidence that Nos D'Aral recognized all too well. He knew there would be little chance of using the Force to persuade her to let him pass. Should it be necessary, he was ready to resort to violence to get inside. But he thought there might still be another way. He threw back his hood, revealing his alien features. He took deep, slow breaths through his mask, which gave off a deep, angry hiss in response as he tilted his head back slightly to make his tusks more prominent.
"My name is Darth Malishi,"
he said, dropping his already baritone voice a full octave lower.
"I have business with Darth Karad."
The guard hesitated, but held her ground, and he realized she would need more convincing. The Keldor extended his hand, while simultaneously reaching out with the Force to apply a faint pressure on her windpipe.
She threw her hands up to her throat, and her eyes went wide with terror as her air supply was cut off. After a few moments, he released his hold, causing her to collapse to her knees as she took in deep, desperate gulps of oxygen.
"When a superior wants to pass, you would be wise to step aside."
"Forgive me, my lord,"
the guard gasped as she crawled out of his way. Keeping her eyes carefully averted to the ground, she said,
"I will inform Darth Karad of your arrival."
"Darth Karad is expecting me. I refuse to wait so my presence can be announced by some groveling worm."
He sneered as he brushed past her. The second guard made no move to stop him. Instead, he cowered off to one side, trying very hard not to be noticed. The Jedi moved quickly up the boarding ramp and into the spear, not certain how long the ruse would work. Though the guards hadn't dared to stop him, once he was gone, they would almost surely inform someone on board the ship of their honored guest's arrival. It wouldn't take long after that for someone to realize something was wrong and order security to hunt down the intruder. Still guided by the power of the Force emanating from Darth Karad, he made his way deeper and deeper into the ship. He could feel evil and corruption enveloping him, growing steadily stronger during his descent. And he knew it wasn't because of his former Padawan's presence. When Darth Mekkis had created the Ascendant Spear, she used a combination of experimental technology and Sith alchemy to imbue the ship itself with energies of the dark side. By the time Nos D'Aral stepped into the turbolift that would take him to the black heart of the vessel, the Jedi was feeling physically nauseated from the effects. But he also sensed he was nearing his goal. As he dropped into the very bowels of the ship, the claustrophobic feeling of the dark side pressing in on him from all sides was so strong that he almost didn't sense the soldiers waiting in the corridor just beyond the turbolift's doors. At the last possible instant, the Force granted him a sudden premonition of the lethal trap. Pulling his green-bladed lightsaber from his belt, he dropped to the ground, pressing himself face down flat on the floor as the turbolift came to a stop on the spear's lowest level. The guards' blaster bolts shredded the turbolift's doors as they slid open, ricocheting over Nos D'Aral's head as they carved an arc at waist height. The Jedi responded by lashing out with the Force, hurling the four heavily armored soldiers several meters back down the corridor. Before they even hit the ground, he had sprung to his feet, charging toward them as he threw his lightsaber sidearm. The spinning blade struck the nearest of his foes, slicing through the chest plate of his battle armor and into the vulnerable flesh beneath. The surviving three guards didn't try to regain their feet, instead firing wildly at him from where they lay sprawled on the floor. The Keldor angled his charge toward the sidewall, leaping and planting a foot halfway up the surface to give him leverage for a high, twisting spin that scraped the ceiling, his arms tucked in close to his chest and his horizontal body perfectly parallel to the floor. The unexpected move again caught the soldiers off guard, their bolts whizzing beneath him. He landed on his feet amid his still-prone adversaries, his lightsaber flying back into his hand as he recalled it with the Force. He turned sideways, narrowly dodging fire from the closest soldier, while a pair of quick flicks with his lightsaber deflected the bolts from the other two harmlessly off to either side. The hard heel of his boot slammed down on the helmeted head of the man at his feet. At the same time, he used the Force to pick up the other two and send them crashing into the ceiling before letting them drop back down to the floor. Momentarily stunned, all three were defenseless against the quick series of cuts and thrusts from his lightsaber that finished them off. Knowing reinforcements wouldn't be far behind, he raced down the hall and burst through the door at the end, coming face to face with Darth Carid and her two apprentices. They were standing in a large circular chamber, his former Padawan in the center, a male human on her right, and a female pure-blooded Sith on her left. Behind Carid, he could see a large crystal sphere, and on the sidewall he saw a small control console. Otherwise, the room was empty. All three of his adversaries wore black armor and sported the fierce facial tattoos so common in those who followed the dark side. Their lightsabers were drawn and ready, the shimmering blades casting a crimson glow over the dimly lit room. Clearly they were expecting him, though whether they had sensed his presence through the Force or had simply been warned by the guards outside, he couldn't say.
"I knew you would come for me one day, Nost Thrall,"
Carid said, her lips curling into a smile of anticipation.
"But even you should know better than to challenge me here on my own ship."
"A Jedi pursues the dark side, no matter where it tries to hide,"
he answered.
"Noble and foolish as ever,"
she mocked.
"You have no idea of how powerful I've become. Malgus showed me the true power,"
she said, her voice slowly rising with each word.
"He led me down the path to greatness. He revealed the secrets you dared not face. He taught me to embrace all things that Jedi fear,"
she shouted, her voice echoing off the circular chamber's walls.
"Now I will use them to destroy you and every follower you have brought onto my ship."
"I have come alone,"
Nost Thrall replied, remaining calm in the face of her growing anger.
"It was my decision to send you to Darth Malgus. I started you on this path. No one else is to blame."
"How quaint,"
she said with a sneer.
"I thought you'd led a strike team here to kill me. But you just want to save your Padawan from the perils of the dark side."
"I will purge the galaxy of the evil I unleashed upon it,"
he said, his voice betraying nothing beyond firm resolution.
"Whether this ends in redemption or death is your decision, not mine."
Carid casually twirled her lightsaber, carving long, lazy circles in the air as her apprentices fanned out to either side, slowly moving into position to flank the Jedi.
"I heard tales of your great prowess in battle while I was on Tython,"
she told him.
"But during all my years as a Padawan, I never saw any evidence of it. I'm curious to see how badly your reputation has been exaggerated."
Nost Thrall sensed Imperial reinforcements drawing near. Spinning back to the door behind him, he thrust his lightsaber into the access panel on the wall, sending up a shower of sparks as he fried the circuits, sealing the door so nobody else could enter the room. He wheeled back to face Carid and her apprentices, and slowly circled to his left, keeping his back against the wall as he tried to gauge the strength of his opponents.
You've given yourself over to the Ascendant Spear,
Nosterall warned his former Padawan, holding his own weapon steady in front of him, two hands on the hilt in a classic defensive posture.
It has consumed your thoughts and training. In learning to master this ship, your other skills have atrophied.
That is why I don't intend to face you alone,
Karen said. A slight nod of the Falling's head sent her apprentices rushing forward, and Master Nosterall braced to meet their charge. Chapter 24. Theron had no idea what Nosterall was planning, but he knew he had to get on the Ascendant Spear quickly. Instead of heading back to the Golden Galley, where he might hope to steal a boarding pass, he headed for the hangar where the ship had docked. The scene was one of chaos. Hundreds of crew members milled around the hangar, clearly agitated. Six guards stood with weapons drawn, lined up at the base of each of the half-dozen ramps leading into the ship, blocking the way. Theron slipped into the crowd, studying the guards. He quickly realized they weren't allowing anyone to leave the vessel. Anyone trying to board was subject to a lengthy interrogation and inspection of their ID before being allowed to pass. The delay was causing a steady increase in the crowd waiting impatiently to be allowed back on. Whatever Nosterall had done had caused security to clamp down hard.
What's going on?
Theron asked a tall woman beside him.
Your guess is as good as mine, she answered, clearly annoyed and not entirely sober.
I just want to get back to my bunk.
There were angry murmurs in the crowd, and a handful of people actually pushed through to verbally confront the guards at the base of the boarding ramps, something that would never have happened a year ago. Imperial citizens were raised in a military culture that trained them to respect authority, but the traditional discipline of the Imperial troops had been frayed by their recent setbacks in the war. And with hundreds of tired and drunk crew members coming back from R&R, tempers were high. An idea struck Theron. It was crazy, impulsive, and risky. In other words, just his style. He worked his way through the crowd, heading out of the hangar and back into Reaver Station. He remembered passing by a small security post, a room where the soldiers responsible for inspecting the incoming vessels could pass the time while they waited for arrivals. With Sea Wing shut down to other traffic because of the Spear's presence, the guard post was unstaffed. Theron paused at the door, glancing around quickly, and made sure nobody in the crowd of people passing by was paying any attention to him. They were too wrapped up in their own thoughts and conversations, or focused on meeting up with friends to enjoy their brief time on the station away from whatever vessel they served on. He pulled the slicer spike from his pocket, concealing it in his palm as he clipped it into the access panel on the wall. He was careful to stand straight and tall, his shoulders back and his head held high as he quickly sliced through the locked door. Hunching over and other furtive behavior would draw far more attention from the people walking by than someone who clearly looked like he had every right to be there. The door slid open, and Theron stepped confidently into the small room beyond before closing it behind him. The guard post was crowded, four chairs packed in around a large control console, with vid screens displaying the various hangars across the station. Empty, pending arrival, security check in progress, cleared to board. Every hangar and Sea Wing was set to the same status, inactive. Because hangar security needed to know the number and size of incoming vessels so they could properly handle inspections, the guard post had access to Reaver Station's external scanners and the early warning beacons. The beacons were the first line of defense, strategically placed to detect incoming vessels long before they actually reached Reaver Station. It didn't take long for Theron to slice into the system. The scanners currently showed a few dozen Imperial vessels in the sector, arriving, departing, or waiting for clearance from the central tower to land. He quickly verified that Tefith was gone. The status display of the hangar where they had docked now read empty. Satisfied, he made a small adjustment to one of the settings on his slicer spike, then began to feed a steady stream of false data into the system. Several dozen vessels ranging in size from single pilot fighters all the way up to full capital ships suddenly materialized on the scanners, popping into existence near the early warning beacons. The data mimicked the effect of a large, well-coordinated fleet dropping from hyperspace all at once on the farthest edges of the sector. A few seconds later, alarms began to ring out through Reaver Station, warning of the simulated Republic attack. The sizzle and hum of clashing blades echoed off the walls of the cavernous chamber as Karad's apprentices engaged Nos D'Aral. Their attacks were basic variations of the Makashi style, a precise and economical lightsaber form designed for maximum results with minimal movement by stressing jabs and thrusts. Their skills were raw. Like Karad, much of their training had focused on developing the unique abilities required to help their master command the Ascendant Spear. They were still able to call on the fury of the dark side to move with astonishing strength and speed, but they hadn't mastered the subtle art of allowing the Force to guide their blades. They were wielding the weapon instead of allowing it to become an extension of themselves. Nevertheless, they were relentless in their attacks, and there were two of them. Nos D'Aral was forced onto the defensive to ward off their attacks, occasionally slipping in quick maneuvers drawn from the more aggressive Ataru form to keep them off balance. Darth Karad merely observed the battle at first, keeping a safe distance from the deadly blade of her former master, while his focus and energies were drained by her apprentices. Realizing he would eventually wear down if he allowed the battle to become a duel of attrition, the Keldor countered with Jem So, the fifth of the seven recognized lightsaber forms. Concentrating his counterattacks exclusively on the physically smaller female Sith, he unleashed a series of savage blows, driving her into a stumbling retreat. For an instant, he was left completely exposed to her human companion, but the unexpected ferocity of Nos D'Aral's sudden switch in tactics caught him unprepared. He hesitated a fraction of a second before thrusting forward, giving the Jedi enough time to leap aside, even as his Sith opponent tripped over her own backpedaling feet and fell to the floor. Nos D'Aral lunged forward to deliver a coup de grace, but his momentum was suddenly reversed, and he found himself sailing backwards as Darth Karad hit him with a powerful Force push. He was able to roll into a back somersault as he hit the ground and sprang back to his feet, but his brief advantage was lost. The two apprentices closed on him again, cutting him off before he could even think about charging toward Karad. As they approached, he sensed the Imperial reinforcements in the hall outside, scrambling to restore power to the sealed door so they could join the fray. Knowing he was running out of time, Nos D'Aral switched tactics again. He thrust out with a powerful Force wave, sweeping them both off their feet. But before he could finish off his prone opponents, Karad unleashed a blast of cackling dark side energy in his direction. Nos D'Aral leapt clear, the deadly blue lightning scorching the floor where he had been standing an instant before. He threw his lightsaber in Karad's direction, sending it end over end on a direct line with his target. The Fallen parried the attack with her own blade, though she was forced to retreat a step to absorb the impact. Nos D'Aral was already in motion, charging past her apprentices before they could scramble to their feet. His lightsaber flew back into his outstretched palm as he fell on Karad. He had trained her in Nemon, the sixth and most balanced form of lightsaber combat. Malgus might have taught her other styles, but faced with Nos D'Aral's furious assault, she instinctively fell back into the one she had learned before all others. Nemon lent itself well to the Jedi ways, eschewing naked aggression for balance and economy of movement that relied on focus and precision. As a Sith Lord who drew her strength from channeling the raw emotional fury of the dark side, the style compromised Karad's abilities. The effect was minimal, but it was more than enough for Nos D'Aral to exploit. He used a quick shove with the Force to send her off balance, and brought his lightsaber in high to strike at her shoulder. When she raised her own blade to block the blow, he dropped low and took her feet out from under her with a sweep of his leg. Karad toppled over, but the Jedi was forced to turn his back on her to engage the female Sith as she leapt to Karad's aid. They exchanged a quick series of blows, plenty of time for Karad to regain her feet. Instead of attempting to finish Nos D'Aral off by attacking from his flank, however, she retreated from the melee, putting the preservation of her own life above the opportunity to finish off her opponent.
The male apprentice joined in a second later, and Nosteral switched to the defensive Sarisu form. He could sense fatigue seeping into his muscles. The toll of the battle was wearing him down, fractionally slowing his blade and leaving him more vulnerable to the force attacks of his enemies. An instant later, the door whooshed open, and a dozen Imperial guards spilled into the room. Carrad held up a hand to indicate they should hold their fire.
The outcome is inevitable,
Carrad called out to him as he fought off the twin attacks of her apprentices.
I sense your exhaustion. Throw down your weapon, and I will let you beg for mercy.
Nosteral hadn't expected to win the battle. From the moment he decided to board the Ascendant Sphere, he'd known defeating Carrad was a near impossibility. But he wasn't about to surrender and grovel at her feet, if for no other reason than that if he did, she would be suspicious, and his true plan would never work.
I didn't come here seeking victory.
Carrad's head tilted to the side as she searched for the meaning behind his words. Failing to grasp it, she turned to the soldiers arrayed just inside the door.
I want him alive,
she told the captain. Nosteral used the last of his dwindling strength to call on the Force for a final desperate leap that sent him hurtling over the apprentices' heads toward his former Padawan. The attack was doomed to failure. There were a dozen ways Carrad could have avoided or repelled the attack, but she didn't even have to react, as the soldiers opened fire with a dozen blasters, all set to stun. The bolts knocked the Jedi from the air and sent him slamming hard to the ground. His lightsaber fell from his paralyzed fingers, the blade extinguished as the hilt clattered to the floor. As he lay there face down, struggling to cling to consciousness, Carrad strode over and picked up his lightsaber, tucking it into her belt like a hunter claiming a trophy from a prized kill. She rolled him over onto his back with her boot, then crouched down to peer into his masked face.
You know you couldn't win this battle, so why did you really come here?
Nosteral had no intention of answering her question, but even if he had, his voice would have been drowned out by the sounds of an alarm ringing through the ship. Carrad snapped her head in the direction of the guard captain, who was listening intently to a message coming over the receiver in his ear.
Reaver Station is under attack, he blurted out. A Republic fleet has been detected in the sector. ETA, 16 minutes.
Activate our shields,
Carrad answered, concerned but not panicked.
Recall all crew to their posts. We leave dock in 12 minutes. Anyone not on board will be left behind and face a full court-martial.
As the captain relayed her commands to the person on the other end of the transmission, Carrad turned back to look down at Nosteral.
Was this your plan? Sacrifice yourself so the Republic could catch us in port and unprepared? Or is there more to your scheme?
Nosteral stayed silent, the edges of his vision growing dim as the blackness closed in, the blaring alarms growing fainter and more distant. Just before he finally lost consciousness, he heard Carrad say,
This is another battle you cannot win. The Imperial interrogators will make you tell me everything.
Reaver Station was in chaos. The alarms echoing through the station were quickly matched by alarms from every ship docked in the hangars as the central tower spread word of the Republic fleet closing in. Men and women sprinted back to their vessels, scrambling to get to their battle stations before the enemy arrived. Theron didn't know how long it would take for his ruse to be discovered, but he knew he had to act fast. He ran from the guard post, joining the stampede of soldiers bearing down on the hangar where the Ascendant Spear was docked. As he burst into the bay, he was swept up in the crowd and carried toward the ramps. The guards keeping the crew from boarding the ship were gone, either recalled onto the spear or overwhelmed by the sudden crush of people scrambling to get to their posts. Theron continued to let the crowd carry him along, heading up the ramp and into the vessel. Once aboard, the crowd thinned quickly as people broke off in different directions, heading to their assigned stations. Theron did his best to look like he knew where he was going, though in truth, he had no idea. He'd only had time to plan out how he'd get himself on the ship. Now that he was aboard, he needed to figure out something new, and it was hard to concentrate due to the incessant clang of the spear's warning klaxon. It wasn't unheard of for new crew members to get lost when first assigned to a ship as large as the Ascendant Spear, and there were diagrams of the ship's basic layout posted at several places along the bulkheads. He stopped to check one, quickly memorizing the layout before choosing his destination. He needed somewhere with access to the ship's main systems, so he could slice in and plant the virus, but it had to be isolated enough for him to work in private. His eyes fell on the engine room near the rear of the ship, separated from the rest of the vessel by a heavily shielded bulkhead to guard against explosions and radioactive discharges. It was accessible only through a single maintenance hatch. Moving with a new sense of purpose, he worked his way through the ship toward the turbolift leading down to the vessel's lowest level. He encountered fewer and fewer people as he went, and by the time he reached the lift, he was alone. Before he could press the button to call it, the doors slid open to reveal a short, heavyset woman in a major's uniform.
"Corporal?"
she snapped on seeing Theron waiting for the elevator.
"Where do you think you're going?"
"Sorry, sir,"
Theron said, slurring his words and snapping off a sloppy salute. He squinted, one eye closed, as he swayed unsteadily on his feet.
"Gotta get to my post."
"This lift is reserved,"
she barked, her voice even louder than the incessant alarms.
"Authorized personnel only."
"Alarms woke me up,"
Theron mumbled.
"Gotta get to engineering.
"You're drunk,"
she spat, her voice filled with disgust.
"Are you scheduled for duty?"
0900,
he replied.
"That's not for another 6 hours,
she said with an exasperated shake of her head.
"Go back and sleep it off in your bunk."
"Sure thing, sir,"
Theron said, fumbling out another clumsy salute. He turned and staggered off in the opposite direction, down the corridor and around the corner. Once he was out of sight, he dropped the act and moved quickly down the passage, taking a series of twists and turns that eventually doubled him back to the turbolift. Peering around the corner, he made sure the Major was gone before making a dash for the lift. He waited impatiently for the doors to open, then slipped inside and punched the button for G-Deck, hoping he wouldn't run into anyone else. Luck was with him. He didn't see anybody as he made his way from the elevator to the engine room's access hatch. Unlike the automated doors controlled by access panels, this was an old Durasteel hinge model, opened by turning a heavy wheel in the center of the hatch. The wheel was stiff from lack of use, and despite his best efforts, Theron couldn't budge it. He realized the maintenance crew probably used a wrench to gain the necessary leverage, but all he had was his pistol. He looked around the empty corridor, trying to find something else he could use. Seeing nothing, he shrugged and pulled the blaster from the holster on his hip, jamming it into the spokes of the door's wheel. Grabbing the pistol's grip with one hand and the barrel with the other, he pulled for all he was worth. The veins on his neck bulged as his muscles strained. Just as he thought he was about to pass out from the effort, the wheel let loose with a groan and moved a quarter turn. Theron adjusted his grip on the pistol and pulled again. The wheel moved more easily this time, another quarter turn. He regripped for a third time and pulled. The wheel completed its revolution, and the door popped open with a loud clang. Standing motionless, he waited to see if anyone would respond to the noise, but all he heard was the clanging alarm. When he removed the pistol from the spokes of the wheel, he noticed that the barrel had been bent. The weapon was useless. Out of habit, he slapped it into his leg holster, then stepped in through the hatch, pulling the heavy Durasteel door closed behind him. He turned the wheel on the inside a quarter turn, enough to keep the hatch from popping open, but not so far he'd have to struggle to open it when he was ready to get out. He was standing on a narrow metal walkway that ran the full 40-meter length of the engine room. To his left was a reinforced bulkhead. To his right, the Spear's massive hyperdrive and the enormous ion engines that propelled the ship when it moved at sublight speeds.
The walls and ceiling were covered with a maze of pipes, tubes, cords, and wires running among hundreds of seemingly random placed electrical boxes, fuse panels, and computer chip relays. In addition to the alarms he could still hear and feel through the vibrations in the walkway, there was a steady, low-pitched hum coming from the ion engines. The air in the engine room was 20 degrees warmer than the corridor he had just come in from, and it smelled of ozone and burning plastic.
If the heat doesn't make me pass out, the fumes just might, Theron thought.
There were no control panels down here in the bowels of the ship, but Theron knew he could slice the spear by tapping directly into the main system. All he had to do was figure out which of the hundreds of wires and relays connected the engine room to the primary command console on the bridge.
Shouldn't take more than a few hours, right?
To his relief, the clanging alarms finally stopped. The blessed silence was broken by two long blasts from a distant horn, and the ground shifted under his feet as the Ascendant Spear disengaged from Reaver Station.
Guess you're not leaving anytime soon, he thought. Might as well get to work.
Chapter 25.
The Imperial Shuttle's 10-hour journey from Reaver Station back to Jagani Port gave Tefith plenty of time to think about her deal with Theron. She wasn't entirely sure what had happened, but the basic details were clear. Theron and the weird-looking Jedi were trying something crazy and foolish, and if she didn't deliver her message to Grandmaster Satil Shan, a lot of people were going to die. She tried to tell herself she didn't really care what happened to a bunch of people she'd never met. But during the long flight, her mind kept conjuring up images of orbital cities and ruins. The bodies of men, women, and children scattered among the wreckage. She'd seen plenty of pictures of death and destruction on the holovids and never given them a second thought. But this was different. Those people were already dead. There was no point worrying about them. The ones on Duro were still alive.
No profit for us in letting them die, she thought,
reminding herself why she was really doing this. Theron had promised her a big, fat payday when this was all over. And it wasn't like she was taking any real risk. Agreeing to the job had actually gotten her off Reaver Station before the Jedi and Theron pulled off whatever crazy stunt they were planning.
Only risk is if Theron doesn't make it, she thought.
She realized the thought of him dying on Reaver Station actually bothered her more than thinking of all the nameless victims on Duro. Try as she might, she couldn't convince herself it was entirely because he wouldn't be able to pay her. She slept for a few hours, letting the shuttle's autopilot navigate through hyperspace. She dreamed of Nagani Jo, the crazy old Jedi who'd thrown himself in front of a blaster bolt meant for her, sacrificing his life for her own. But she didn't dream of their time together or his death. In her dreams, it was like the old man had never left. Tefith was on the Imperial Shuttle, heading back to Jagani. Nagani Jo was sitting in the seat beside her. His scraggly gray hair and bushy eyebrows were wild and disheveled. Looking at him, it wouldn't be hard to imagine he had never owned a comb in his life. He wore an old Jedi robe, wrinkled and stained, with the hood thrown back. There were several charred holes in his chest where the blasters had ripped through him, but his blue eyes were sharp and bright.
I expected better from you, Tefith, he said. You think I gave up my life just so you could keep on working for the Black Sun?
Work for old Tion Brotherhood now.
That's not the point.
Big things ahead for us.
At least we agree on that.
Why did you save us?
A beep from the autopilot alerting her that they were preparing to drop out of hyperspace startled her awake before the man in her dream could give her an answer.
Stupid Jedi,
Tefith muttered as she switched the shuttle over to manual control. She dropped from hyperspace in the Decebro system, charted a course for the shuttle to bring her into Jagani Port, then opened a holochannel.
Welcome back, sunshine,
Gorbich said once the holo was connected.
Quick turnaround. I guess everything must have gone real smooth.
Not smooth. Left Jedi and Theron at Reva Station.
Gorvitch chuckled.
Sounds like a good story. Lay it on me.
Not overcome, Channels. Meet us at Jedi's fancy shuttle. You move it?
Nah, it's still in the hangar at Jagani Port. How long till you get there?
30 minutes,
she said, flicking off the holo so she wouldn't have to deal with Gorvitch for 1 second longer than absolutely necessary. By the time she arrived at the hangar where the Prosperity was parked, Gorvitch was already waiting for her.
Okay, Sunshine, we're here. So what's the deal? Why'd you ditch the others?
She hesitated, choosing her words carefully. She wanted to tell Gorvitch as little about what had happened as possible. If he knew Theron had offered her 10,000 credits, he'd want a cut.
Didn't ditch them. Told us to go. Need us to deliver a message.
I don't follow,
Gorvitch said, scratching his head.
You going back to pick them up later?
Not part of the plan.
So how are they going to get off Reva Station?
Tefeth shrugged.
Never told us. Just said take shuttle, go deliver message.
Gorvitch shook his head.
I knew they were up to something funny. This won't come back later and bite me when I'm not looking, will it?
You'll be fine,
the Twi'lek assured him. Gorvitch crossed his arms and stared at Tefeth, his eyes staying above the neck for a change.
I know you're keeping something from me, Sunshine. But I'll let it slide since you set this whole deal up.
Still owe us our cuts,
she reminded him.
Don't worry. I got the credits stashed away somewhere safe.
Gorvitch laughed, a mean, spiteful sound.
Guess we aren't gonna get those bonus credits your friend promised, though.
Might still make it off Reva Station,
Tefeth said, a little more defensively than she intended.
I'm just gonna assume he's not coming back,
Gorvitch said.
Good thing we took this shuttle for collateral. Already got a couple of buyers lined up.
Seeing Tefeth scowl, he added,
Hey, I didn't think any of you was gonna make it back.
Why, you sent us with them. Want to keep all the credits for yourself?
Water under the bridge, Sunshine,
he said with an indifferent shrug.
Now that you're back, I'm happy to share.
Cancel shuttle,
she told him, already tiring of the conversation.
Needed to deliver a message.
Whoa, hold on a second. What are you talking about? You think I'm just gonna let you take off in my collateral?
Gorvitch's eyes narrowed.
How do I know you and your friends aren't trying to pull a fast one? You say they're still on Reva Station, but for all I know, you dropped them off at some luxury resort. Then they send you back here to get the Prosperity so you can all meet up later and get out of paying me the rest of the credits I was promised.
Idiot,
Tefeth said with a shake of her head, turning away from him and heading toward the shuttle.
One more step and I ventilate your pretty little skull, Sunshine.
She turned around slowly to see Gorvitch had drawn his blaster and was pointing it right at her.
Saved your life on Nash Adar,
she hissed.
That's why I didn't shoot you in the back,
he admitted.
But I don't like being played, so stop holding out and tell me what's really going on.
Tefeth bit her lip, trying to find a way to talk herself out of this without having to cut Gorvitch in on her side deal. In the end, she couldn't do it.
Theron offered 10,000 credits to deliver a message to Coruscant. Got to take fancy shuttle to get there in time.
10,000 credits, huh?
Gorvitch lowered his blaster, though he didn't put it away.
Cut you in for 3,
Tefeth said.
Hold on a second, Sunshine,
he said, holding up his free hand.
You really believe you're gonna get 10,000 credits just to deliver a message to Coruscant? You're dreaming.
Deal's good,
she insisted, not wanting to get into the details.
You don't think Coruscant Customs has access to the Prosperity's records? They'll toss you in jail for theft the second you touch down.
Tefeth hadn't considered that. Hopefully she'd be able to convince the authorities that she really did have an urgent message for Grandmaster Satil Shan.
Ha! Didn't think of that, did you?
Gorvitch gloated, recognizing the reason for a silence.
See, that's why you need me around, watching out for you.
Worth the risk,
Tefeth argued.
10,000 credits, too good to pass up.
If he pays you. He already owes us another 20 on credit. Remember how we renegotiated the original deal? He says 10 now, but when it comes time to pay, who knows how much he'll actually be willing to fork over? Maybe zero.
Won't be zero,
Tefeth grumbled.
Even if he comes through with the 10 he promised, and the 20 he already owes us, I got a better deal for you,
Gorbatch said.
Forget about the message. We sell the prosperity and split the profit. We both come out way ahead in that game.
Tefeth wasn't surprised by Gorbatch's plan. He was a despicable man with no honor. But he knew how to turn a profit. And everything he'd said about Theron was true. Theron had reneged on the original deal. And even if she delivered the message and he didn't double-cross her, there was a good chance whatever crazy plan he was trying to pull off wouldn't work. If he was killed or captured by the Sith, she could kiss her credits goodbye.
Well, sunshine, what's it gonna be?
How much we get for the shuttle?
50,000, easy. Plus I still got your cut of the 30 I stashed away.
If she tried to help Theron, Gorbatch might just shoot her where she stood. Even if she tricked or overpowered him, her days with the old Tian Brotherhood would be over. And there was a good chance she might not get paid anyway. Or she could abandon Theron, keep working with Gorbatch, and continue climbing the ranks of the Brotherhood while making an easy 40,000 credits.
Good money, sunshine,
Gorbatch prodded.
Enough to ease any guilt about betraying a friend.
And how long do you betray us?
Tefeth thought. Tefeth sprang into action, hoping to catch Gorbatch off guard as he waited for her answer. He was standing 3 steps away from her, his gun still pointed casually at the ground. Her first step was free. On her second, his eyes went wide with the realization of what was happening. On the third, he was bringing the gun up, but he only got it halfway before she knocked it out of his hand with a spinning back kick. She followed it up with a jumping front kick, swinging her foot as hard as she could and catching him right between the legs. Gorbatch collapsed on the ground, curled up in the fetal position, groaning softly. Tefeth scooped up his fallen pistol, pointed it at him, then decided not to pull the trigger. Instead, she tucked it into her belt and raced over to the shuttle. She punched in the access code, and the Prosperity's boarding ramp descended with a soft hiss from the pressurized cabin. She ran up it, turning to glance back at Gorbatch. He was still on the floor, but he was crawling toward the ship. He met her eye with a hate-filled gaze. Something in that look made Tefeth realize he wasn't done yet. Reacting on pure instinct, she threw herself back and to the side, grabbing one of the boarding ramp struts to keep from falling off. At the same time, Gorbatch's hand flickered, dropping to the sharpened blade he kept strapped to his thigh and hurling it in her direction with a single well-practiced motion, almost too quick for the eye to follow. The blade buried itself deep in Tefeth's shoulder, almost knocking her off the boarding ramp. Using the strut for leverage, she hauled herself into the ship and hit the button to close the boarding ramp behind her. Acutely aware that if she hadn't tried to get out of the way, the blade now protruding from her shoulder would have buried itself deep in her back. Ignoring her injury, she rushed to the cockpit, fired up the engine, sent the signal to open the hangar doors, and took to the air. Back on the ground, Gorbatch crawled over to the control panel and hauled himself up, slamming the button to close the hangar doors with his fist. Tefeth saw the hangar doors stop at halfway open, then slowly start to close again. She gritted her teeth, yanked back hard on the control stick to send the ship hurtling forward, and braced for impact. The Prosperity's hull, like everything else about the vessel, was top of the line. The multiple layers of durasteel plating and the reinforced frame struck the hangar's doors and wrenched them off their hinges, sending them flying as the thrusters powered the ship on through and up into the sky. Climbing toward the upper atmosphere, Tefeth felt a subtle shimmy in the shuttle's formerly velvet-smooth ride, but checking the ship's instrument panel showed no significant damage. A few minutes later, she was far enough away from the planet's gravitational field to engage the hyperspace drive and activate the advanced autopilot to take her to Coruscant. Only then did she tend to her wounded shoulder, digging out the med kit from beneath the pilot seat. She inspected the blade, making sure she wouldn't bleed out if she pulled it free. Fortunately, it had struck muscle and bone rather than a major artery, and she was able to remove it without any real difficulty. Though doing so made her tilt her head back and scream. blocking out the pain. She treated and dressed the wound with the efficiency of one all too familiar with administering back-alley medicine. She inspected her work one final time before finally taking a pair of Colto-filled hypodermics and jabbing them into her thigh. The pain disappeared almost instantly, and she felt a pleasant warmth spreading through her. She shifted in her seat, and the chair responded by automatically adjusting itself to her new position, enveloping her in luxurious comfort. She turned her head to the side and saw Nagani Joe once again sitting in the seat beside her.
I'm proud of you, my girl, for sparing Gorvitch and for making the right choice.
No, maybe stupid Jedi leave us alone,
she murmured, her words tailing off into a soft snore.
I have the latest casualty estimates for tomorrow's attack on Duro, the director said.
Do you really think I want to see them?
Jace asked. The Supreme Commander was slumped in the chair behind his desk, his hand clutching an empty glass. He leaned forward and grabbed the long neck of the half-full bottle in front of him and refilled his drink for what Marcus guessed wasn't the first time this evening.
The extra patrols you're sending help. Not much, but a little.
We save a few hundred,
Jace grunted bitterly.
But we still sacrifice thousands.
We could try to come up with an excuse to have an actual fleet orbiting the planet, the director suggested. Make up some honor to give one of Duro's citizens. Have the ships there as part of the celebration.
Imagine you're the Imperial Minister of Logistics,
Jace said, his words clear despite the alcohol he'd consumed.
What would you think if you found a ceremonial fleet stationed at Duro when you launched your surprise attack? Would you believe it was just coincidence?
The director sighed.
No. I think the cipher codes had been compromised.
Jace raised his drink in a silent toast to his honesty, then downed it in a single gulp.
Grab yourself a glass,
he said, nodding over to the bar in the corner as he refilled his own. The director did just that before sitting in one of the chairs on the opposite side of the Supreme Commander's desk. Jace held the bottle up, and Marcus extended his glass.
You think Theron's going to follow through on the mission?
Jace asked as he poured. Marcus drained half his drink before answering.
He's my best agent.
You used to say he was one of the best,
Jace noted.
I upgraded him after he brought back the Black Cipher.
What about Nos D'Rahl? He's a Jedi.
Jace emptied his glass again.
They're not always great at following orders that don't fit their understanding of the universe.
I think he's smart enough to understand why we had to do this. And aborting the mission doesn't help Duro.
So you think they'll go forward?
I think so. They both care too much about the Republic to let this go off the rails.
And after this is over, after we bring down the spear and finally put an end to this blasted war, you think Theron will ever forgive me?
The director didn't answer. Instead, he just drained what was left of his drink.
Do you support my decision?
Jace wanted to know.
I do, Marcus said. It's the right call. Don't know if I could have made it, though. And I don't know how either of us is supposed to live with it.
Jace grabbed the bottle and refilled their glasses.
Making a decision like this is brutal,
the Supreme Commander agreed.
But living with it is worse.
Chapter 26.
Hunched over one of the many computer relay panels in the Ascendant Spear's engine room, Theron wiped the sweat away from his brow before it ran down and stung his eyes. With the help of his slicer spike, he tapped into the panel and ran a diagnostic search to map out the various systems it was connected to. Theron had been hiding in the engine room ever since the spear left Reaver Station. He had no way to get off the vessel until it docked again, short of stealing an escape pod, which would trigger an emergency alarm and get him blasted out of existence. Fortunately, the hours he'd been stuck on the narrow walkway in the sweltering, reeking engine room had actually proved beneficial. Realizing he wasn't going anywhere soon, Theron had spent his time trying to get a better understanding of the vessel's inner workings. Mapping each relay individually was a simple but time-consuming process, one he'd already repeated over a dozen times. But the grueling work was the key to piecing together a complete picture of the Spear's control systems. There was no single central network connecting everything. Each system was controlled independently, linked to several different relays that could allow functionality to be rerouted through multiple pathways if something went wrong. His exploration of the engine room was proving to be simultaneously exhausting, fascinating, and disheartening. The complexity of the ship was mind-boggling. It was the crowning achievement of Darth Mekus' experimental weapons program. SIS had long suspected that there was some kind of link between the vessel itself and whoever was in command. Mekus had specialized in combining biology and cybernetics. But the full scope of the symbiotic relationship went far beyond anything that they had theorized. Whenever Theron sliced into a computer terminal, his cybernetic implants allowed him to interface directly with the network. But there was still a wall of separation, a clear distinction between user and device. Mekus had found a way to tear down that wall. When Carid was in command of the Spear, the ship became part of her. Or maybe she became part of the ship. They were inseparable. The connection gave her the ability to read and react almost instantly during a battle. The Spear's sensors relaying information directly into her awareness, then responding immediately to her commands. It also gave her a heightened awareness of everything that was happening with the vessel's systems while she was linked to the ship. Theron would have to be extremely cautious with anything he did, taking extra care to use a light touch so Carid wouldn't sense his presence. And he realized the original plan of planting a dormant virus probably wouldn't work. Even if Carid didn't notice the intrusion, the Spear had multiple layers of safeguards and redundancies that would quickly isolate and disable the virus. The relays cutting off the malware as they rerouted the damaged functions through a new path. The only hope of effectively sabotaging the vessel was for Theron to be actively slicing the system while the Spear was in battle, shifting and switching his electronic attacks to stay a step ahead of the vessel's security protocols. The dilemma of how he was supposed to actually get off the ship if he was actively sabotaging it in the middle of a battle was something he tried not to worry about for the moment. On the plus side, the Spear's unique design allowed Theron's own cybernetic implants to operate at peak efficiency while he was plugged into the ship, giving him a level of access unlike anything he'd experienced before. He'd already managed to patch into the ship's internal communications, allowing the implant in his ear to receive all their transmissions.
Red Patrol checking in. E-deck is clear. Proceeding to F-deck.
Theron sighed and disconnected his slicer spike from the panel. He stood up straight, stretching to ease a crick in his back. Tapping into the comm systems had allowed him to follow the progress of the security patrols Carid had dispatched once she realized the Republic fleet hadn't really existed. Theron had been tracking them closely as they systematically worked their way through each level of the vessel, wing by wing. He hated to interrupt his work, but it was time to move if he didn't want to be discovered. He went to the Durasteel maintenance hatch and slowly turned the wheel to open it. There was a sharp clink as the hatch popped free, and a soft squeak from the hinges as it swung open. Theron poked his head out into the corridor, not expecting to see anyone, but also not willing to take any chances. His only weapon was the blaster he had tucked in the holster of his uniform, but he had no intention of firing it after bending the barrel prying open the engine room security hatch. Fortunately, the hall was deserted, so he climbed out and closed the hatch behind him, trying not to make any noise. He worked his way down the hall, listening intently for the footsteps of anyone approaching. It wasn't likely he would run into anybody. G-Deck consisted primarily of the engine room, and, way on the opposite end, the Spear's private command chamber. Apart from the security sweep, nobody had any reason to be on the level. Even Carid wouldn't venture down unless the Spear was about to go into battle. Two turbolifts